So this is work that I did with my now graduated PhD student, Gene Novark. Gene is clearly smarter than us. He's now at Morgan Stanley. So this is work, like I said, done with them. This was actually inspired by some work, some earlier work that I did in conjunction with a colleague of mine at Microsoft Research called DieHard. So DieHard was a system designed to provide fault tolerance, not security. And it actually ended up getting rolled into Windows 7. It's considered the direct inspiration for Windows 7's fault-tolerant heap, which is a nice piece of engineering. However, they diluted DieHard a little bit, to say the least. So it incorporates a number of the features that make DieHard resilient to failure, that is fault-tolerant. But in particular, DieHard relies on randomness. It provides probabilistic memory safety, and Microsoft basically ran in fear from randomness. There's a number of good reasons for this, mostly having to do with reproducibility. However, I argued that DieHard probably provided some substantial security benefits, and since they were concerned with increasing security in Windows 8, I'm not revealing any secrets here, by the way, I'm just saying they're interested in security. Surprise. So I said, you know, randomization really is crucial for security. And they said, no, we're okay with just putting in canaries. So canaries are these little things, you know, the story of the canary in the coal mine. All right, the canary detects failure. And they said, well, we'll be able to discover attacks. So I found that it was difficult to convince them. And then I realized it was actually difficult to convince myself that any of these features actually materially added to security. So we had this brainstorming session, we talked about all kinds of different possibilities, and they were all really cool and interesting, but at the end of the day, we were sort of like, well, this seems like a good thing. And I realized we really had no way of understanding whether one of these features increased security or not. So the paper gets into some technical detail about analyzing previous memory allocators and talks a lot about all kinds of previous memory allocators and their designs, what makes them susceptible to security attacks and what doesn't. But I'm not going to go into much technical detail here. Instead, I'm going to try to convey the feeling or the intuition behind the analysis by way of an analogy, which I'll be extending throughout this talk. Okay, so my apologies in advance to those French or German citizens in the audience. This is just an analogy. So you can decide who's going to be more offended. For the purposes of this talk, France is representing Microsoft or any really commercial enterprise, and Germany is representing black hats. All right, so Germany is the hackers. And, you know, France and Germany, those of you who are students of history are aware, have somewhat of a checkered history. The relationship has not been always the best. In fact, there have been frequent attacks from usually the German side, let's say, that are met with some sort of a response. Of course, there should be arrows coming in from the United States, but, you know. Anyway, and then there's an intervening period of peace. And then at some point later, there's another attack, and then, you know, defense and so on. So, you know, the French got kind of tired of this. Who wouldn't, right? And so the French actually decided to take matters into their own hands and do something that would prevent all future attacks from these German hackers. Again, those of you who are students of history will remember the Maginot Line. The Maginot Line, it's often discussed in sort of insulting or condescending terms in the United States, but actually it's quite an amazing piece of engineering, and they spent an unbelievable amount of money to build this thing. This is just one of the many stations that pepper the border between Germany and France, more on that later. But they're incredibly intricate and very sophisticated, and you can understand after spending what would be $100 billion roughly in today's dollars, how they were convinced this was a good thing. So, this is guarding France, guarding Windows. The idea, right, is that, You can have an army that's completely protected. Each station was self-sufficient. There were electric railroads that connected the stations deep underground. If you go to France, you can actually see these little pillboxes, and some of them you can tour these things. And they're in a tremendously good state of preservation, which is not going to be surprising in a second. And for those of you who are aware of the history, you'll know why. So here's what they did. They built this elaborate set of fortified compounds all across the border. And you'll see the solid line over here, see if it's visible. The solid line here represents where those emplacements were most concentrated. And here is where those emplacements were a little less dense. So what happened? Yeah, they went through Belgium. Right, so that's the problem, right? So they believed that they had security because they protected themselves very densely against the borders that they shared with Germany. However, Belgium was a neutral country, and in principle, that meant that it was off limits. And so the Germans broke the rules and found a way around the emplacements, which is why they're in such good condition today, because they weren't used. All right, so back to the analogy. The question is, when you're in one of these periods of peace, once you've shut down a bunch of these attacks, how do you know that you're done, right? Or have you just built another Maginot Line that's going to be overrun through something you hadn't considered, right? So that's what this talk is really about, or what the paper is about more. I'm just focusing on the heap today. Not talking about the stack or code. There's lots of well-known defenses for these things, but you know, that's scary, right? So, okay. So, to continue with my belligerent analogy, I'm going to be using Stratego, a board game, as an analogy. How many of you have played or are familiar with Stratego? All right. There seems to be some correlation with age here, which is a little depressing. All right, so... So, for those of you who have not played Stratego, which, by the way, is I would say, one of those things that you, as a geek, are required to learn, there's a wonderful video of a Star Wars premiere with Triumph the Insult Dog. I highly recommend some people playing Stratego outside. How Stratego works, it's essentially a military-style game. Really, in fact, is actually explicitly modeled after the Franco-Prussian War. And the way it works is that you have two sides. So here, a red and a blue side. Each player can only see the fronts of their pieces, which have little point numbers on them. And then the other players are obfuscated, right? They're just dark. So you have a range of choices. You have a bunch of different types of characters. The lower numbered are more powerful. The higher numbered are weaker. You have more higher powered one or more higher numbers than the low ones. There's bombs. But really, at the end of the day, it's a game of capture the flag. So the idea in Stratego is to go and find your opponent's flag, which, as you can see on this board, is not obvious, right? You see a bunch of red. You need to find the flag, and you need to get it. And once you get the flag, you win, all right? So for the purposes of this talk, I'm just going to pretend we have a really, really simple Stratego game that has two pieces. It has flags, and it has bombs. If you run into a bomb, then your piece is destroyed, unless it's a special piece, but we're not going to talk about that today. And if you manage to capture the flag, you win. All right? Very simple. So here is a potential board layout. So the way you have all your pieces, there's some natural obstacles. Pretend these are Belgium. So you place your flag and your bomb. And if an attacker goes and hits your flag, then you're owned. Right? They've captured your machine. If, on the other hand, they hit a bomb, what's going to happen in our world in Windows, is you'll get some sort of a message. So let me just say that, again, to carry home this analogy, I'm not really talking about Stratego, I'm talking about data. In our model, our attack model, it's an extremely aggressive attack model, I guess as befits the flavor of this talk. Anything on the heap is considered sensitive. So any data that's placed on the heap, we just assume it's all sensitive. So we're not making any assumptions at all. We're, in fact, making the worst possible assumption. All right, so all data is sensitive, so all data is flags. However, bombs are pages that are guard pages or unmapped pages. So if you try to access any of this memory, then you get this, right? So this, from our perspective, is success, all right? We win, strangely, if our computer freezes, right? If we get a crash. And the reason is that we've prevented something that's arguably worse, which is getting taken over, okay? All right, so here is the current state of the art for Windows and Linux. It's not the best strategy. I should add, just lots of flags. There is some clever modification you can get where the flags move around en masse. This is known as address space layout randomization. It's not that great. So to get down a little bit deeper, why do I say everything is a flag? So clearly you have data on the heap and the data is sort of just gets shuffled around. There's also this stuff called metadata. And metadata in effect means that no matter what you do, even if you have nothing vulnerable on the heap, the metadata itself allows an attacker to take over, right? So this metadata, for example, for libc and for Windows and others, contains information that's used in the accounting of the heap. It's actually the data structure parts of the heap. And if you manage to corrupt a little piece of it, you can actually corrupt the entire heap and take it over. And there are lots of really clever and interesting attacks that leverage these. And how do they happen? They happen because objects are immediately located next to this metadata. So you can have some sort of an overflow, like in this case, where there's just a little bit of a buffer overflow, and it's going to land on this piece of metadata, and you're going to be owned. All right? Okay, so back to the example. This is, like I said, how it worked for Windows, but what we can do is we can be a little more clever, and we could interject some bombs, right? That seems like a good strategy, right? Let's put some bombs in there. This is something that was suggested as a possible way of dealing with this problem. So bombs are a good thing, because it means that now you can't just take over the heap no matter where you strike, all right? However, really, if you think about it, if the bombs are in the same damn place every time, right? Suppose you're playing with somebody, and every time they play Stratego, they lay out the board the same way. Well, the first time, you may not win, okay? But you're going to win every other time, right? Because as soon as you find out where a flag is, you're going to know where the flag is every time. And sadly, this is in effect what happens now, and even if you go and you just throw bombs in some strategic places, you're the world's worst Stratego player, right? This is not going to help. So what can you do? So what you could do, you might think this would be a good idea, let's break up the heap. All right? This is a good idea, by the way. All right? So let's, instead of actually having the these flags and these bombs scattered around like this, let's go ahead and spread more bombs around. And in fact, we'd like to do this randomly. All right? So the little blowfish down here represents OpenBSD. So this is something OpenBSD does. The asterisk is because, in fact, OpenBSD doesn't do this out of the box. It does some things out of the box, but it does some things that it So the analysis reveals that there's some things that are optional that you can turn on in OpenBSD that make it run a little slower. However, they're required for security. So this is something that fell out of this analysis. All right, so in effect, so everything that's blank here, what OpenBSD effectively does is it leverages that address space layout randomization that I mentioned before, which was naive, but instead of allocating the heap en masse and just shuffling the whole heap around, it breaks up the heap and places these chunks at different random locations. And then in between, you got nothing but bombs. Okay? Now, on a 64-bit address space, this is a lot of bombs. Okay? And it makes it really, really hard to find the flags at random. All right, so for clarity, I'm going to remove the bombs, but pretend now everywhere where you see nothing, there's bombs. All right, so now I'm some hacker, and I say, okay, time to attack. When I first attack now, I'm going to probably end up hitting a bomb. Right, so now it's going to take longer and longer and longer and longer to find these things. All right, now this is one part of the analysis where we just don't know where any object on the heap is. The bad part is that there are often ways to get information out of the heap. That is, to find out where one object is on the heap. Not necessarily the flag, right? But something right next to a flag. So for example, here, we might find the address of this object. All right, it can be leaked in a variety of ways. Once we know that, then we know all we have to do is jump one forward. We have to overflow this object, and we'll hit a flag. Or if it's not this object, it could be this object, and so on. All right, so now it becomes clear that while we have littered the field with bombs, maybe it's not enough. Because once I, as a Stratego player, find a particular object, and I happen to know right next to that thing is going to be a flag, well, now I'm going to win every time as well. All right? So what does OpenBSD do? So OpenBSD, by default, in fact, actually introduces a little bit of randomization. So what it does, when it allocates these little chunks, it randomly chooses where some of the objects are going to be placed. In particular, it has a very cute little scheme that it uses. So when you free an object, it hashes the address. That address was obtained randomly. And once you free a couple objects into the space, then it sort of does a last in, first out thing and actually frees it. And this has the effect of stirring up the pot a little bit. The little bit is about 4 to 5 bits of entropy. All right. So what does that mean? It means that it increases the difficulty of an attack by a factor of 2 to the 4th or 2 to the 5th, which is good, right? It's better than what Windows and Linux do, right? But it's really not that much entropy, because it just means, I'll be able to take over, instead of taking over every machine in the world instantly, it'll be 1/16th of the world's machines, say. Okay? That's still a pretty substantial fraction. So what we have done with Die Harder, and I should stress, the original motivation of this work, in some sense, was to say, hey, Microsoft, you should just use Die Hard. Use it as it was. Don't dilute it. It's going to be awesome. But it turned out that Die Hard, once we did this analysis, actually fell down a number of ways. So it's still pretty good. But one of the things that Die Hard didn't do was to do this sort of chunklet thing. These chunks breaking up the heap into these little pieces turns out to be very important. The other thing that Die Hard did, which I think is interesting from a practical standpoint, is that Die Hard deliberately delays, implicitly delays the reclamation of objects. So what does that mean? It means if you have a dangling pointer error, it's going to live for a long time. So pretend the heap has 1,000,000 freed objects. The next time you allocate an object, if you choose them all at random, you only have a 1 in 1,000,000 chance of getting the one you just freed. Right? And so on. Right? So you really have to get it over and over and over again to hit that object you accidentally freed too soon. So it provides a lot of resilience. So this is something that the Microsoft people really like, because it keeps programs running. Unfortunately, it turns out that there's a certain class of attack called heap spraying. And heap spraying relies on the ability to fill up the heap with objects. And so if you repeatedly call, in effect, malloc free, malloc free, malloc free, in a heap spraying susceptible framework like a browser, then you can end up filling the heap with the contents of your choice. And because Die Hard was not destroying those contents every time they were freed, which is required to keep the program alive in the face of a dangling pointer error, it made it susceptible to this sort of problem. So now, in fact, Die Harder explicitly destroys objects as soon as they're freed, and that makes this problem go away. So there's the two pieces, destroying objects on free, which is not activated by default in OpenBSD, but should be. It will slow down your programs a little bit. But in addition, this sort of chunk thing. What Die Hard does that goes further than OpenBSD is that the randomization is actually across the entire heap. So when you allocate an object, the location of that object with respect to any other object, it's completely at random. It's not just within the same chunk. So this turns out to maximize entropy. You can't actually do much better. You get about 25 to 30 bits of entropy out, which means that your fraction of the world you can take over is now 1/2 to the 25th or less, which is a very small number. All right, just a little bit of technical detail. This is it. The way that everything works, you randomly obtain pages or these chunks of memory from the OS, and every size of object has its own little set of these pages. And these all point to, so this says this is an object, a page rather that holds objects of some size. And it's all managed by these bitmaps. And when you allocate objects, it's randomly chosen from across all these pages, and then you set the appropriate bit. This turns out, by the way, to be a big O of one allocation and deallocation. So it's relatively efficient, although a little more on that in a second. Okay, so we, of course, did the obligatory thing of running this and comparing it to other allocators. Here's a really boring slide. Maybe the most boring slide. This slide is just, I threw it in here because you sort of have to do this, run it against spec. And yeah, you do get some degradation. All right, where does the degradation come from? You can see in some places, so this is Perl, and here Diehard and Diehard are actually quite similar. What's happened here is that the randomization, which is really required for security, screws up locality. Okay, now it doesn't screw up L1 locality, it doesn't screw up L2 locality, because it's allocating objects, right? But it doesn't play very well with TLBs. In particular, it doesn't play very well with the Intel TLB layout, which is etched in stone, so we're kind of stuck with it. In some cases, there's really no effect at all, but overall, we get a geo mean of around 20%. Okay, so, yay, Perl Bench. You know, calculating perfect numbers and stuff. Very important. We all care about this. What I really care about, obviously, and the place where this matters, is an internet-facing application. Okay? So what we did is we took Firefox and we replaced the allocator with DieHarder. What we then took, I believe, the paper has the details, but it's like the top 20 or 25 sites from Alexa, and we loaded them all, then we cached them on some local server, and then we ran through this thing where it was actually, you know, automatically going to these web pages. Okay? And then we timed it. So it took 44 seconds with the standard allocator. So now ask yourselves, or maybe tell me, what performance degradation would you be willing to accept for your Firefox browsing experience to have this maximal practical amount of security for your heap?
The usual 10%.
The usual 10%. Okay. 10%? Is that it? 2x. All right. Man, you're a braver man than I. All right, 2x. So 88 seconds instead of 44. Man, you really care about security. All right, I like you. Okay, so I've got a big range here, 10% to 2x. Should we split the difference or, I don't know. Sure, okay. All right, so here's what happened. What the hell? Okay, so what happened here, it turns out that this is statistically not significant. So it's not actually improving performance in any way that I would make any claims about. But the good part is, you know, this is actually without any network effects, right? So we had everything cached on a system that was, you know, on the same subnet as the machine we were doing the testing on, and it had effectively no effect. Now, I should add, there are definitely cases for which this is not true. In particular, if you use this sort of Sun Spider type thing that's massively stressing JavaScript, some of them run slower. Okay. However, this includes several sites that use reasonably intensive use of JavaScript, and we couldn't notice a difference. So that wasn't too bad. All right. So that's about it for DieHarder. I'd like to thank you for your attention.
Rick Barrow, and I was really, actually, what's got me interested is the mechanism, which of course you just really skimmed over. So usually, if I understand the way the heap works, they try to keep the mechanism pretty simple. Essentially, the metadata you're talking about is some kind of a form of a linked list.
That's right.
So you're manipulating a linked list. And so you showed something a bit different, and I didn't really have time to catch it.
Yeah, okay.
It looks like a linked list again, but you have something that's not in line, so the metadata is not like sitting in the heap.
Okay, so it's not a linked list, so there are no lists. The data structures that we use are a hash table and bitmaps and arrays. Okay. So just to answer your question as crisply as I can, it's definitely a completely different style of heap. It's definitely of the family of diehard. The key challenge here, I wish I had some backup slides to show you. The key challenge here is how do you do random allocation, truly random allocation, and do it efficiently, right? And there are two problems. The first is speed, and the second is space, all right? The speed one is not so hard to deal with. As long as you allocate more memory than you actually require, what you can do is essentially, this is not what DieHard or DieHarder does, but pretend it does. Pretend you double the amount of memory you require. So whenever you allocate, 1 megabyte, you get 2. And then you randomly allocate objects within that space. So if you randomly allocate objects within a space that's twice as big as required, then the number of probes required to find a free object is going to be 2 on with high probability. So that gets to the speed problem. The space problem is that if you randomly allocated objects of different sizes, you could end up in this horrible situation where you've peppered the heap with little tiny objects, and then when you go to allocate a big object, there's nowhere to put it. Okay? So this would be catastrophic fragmentation. You could just end up, like I said, put a character here, a character here, a character here, then you go to allocate a page, and there's no room. All right. So the way that we get around this is that we segregate the heap by sizes. So every page only holds one size of object. So there's no possibility of fragmentation.
Okay. Good.
All right. Thanks for question. Right now it's power of 2, although there's no actual requirement for that. Okay. It could be something better.
Yeah, that works. Thanks.
All right.
Hi, Mike Ryan, ISI. You said this really messes with TLBs for a really obvious reason, but this is something that we clearly want and need and so on and so forth. Is there any way to actually build hardware caching that would be amenable to performance and yet at the same time, you're dealing with randomization here.
Yeah.
It makes caching hard.
Right. That's an excellent question. So like I said, it really is a problem with the TLB more than with the L1 and L2, and this is really a granularity issue, right? When you allocate an object of size 128, it's all allocated together, right? It doesn't randomly spread out the bits, so the cache locality is good, TLB not so much. The TLB problem is basically an x86-specific issue because the TLB format, that is the page table format, is set in stone. However, there are other architectures that have software TLB management. Right, so you can actually have your own TLB. You can have your own page table entry structure. This was true for Spark. I believe there are other chips as well. I think PowerPC, but don't quote me. If we could only get Intel to change this format, right, or change it to make it a little more flexible, then we could have a sparse format. The problem basically is that the TLB, the way that it works in Intel is it fills in every entry. You touch something, it's like. All right, we don't want that. We just want to say, hey, it's this little piece here. Don't load all this crap into the TLB. So it's definitely doable. We have a citation or two in the paper to some formats that would really improve things.
Another question, this is much more mechanical, but can you go back to the slide that's just filled with bombs?
I'll see what I can do.
So that's
bombs.
That's an OpenBSD specific thing. How do they realize that efficiently? Is it just a bunch of unmapped pages or?
So both Windows and Linux have a nice implementation or nice enough implementation of ASLR, where when you map an individual page, it's chosen at random from a large space. And so everything in between is unmapped. And we make sure that when we free something, we unmap it, or we do the obvious thing. It turns out that Mac OS X, up until Lion, did a really crap job of ASLR, let's say, not to mince words. But apparently Lion has resolved this. I have not yet bitten the bullet to actually see if that's true. But if anybody has installed Lion on their systems and is willing to let me run a very simple test, I would appreciate it.
Trust this man. He's legit. Thank you.